You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Santi Frazier. Santi, thanks so much for being with me today.
No, it's a pleasure. I can't wait to talk about some new work and then just kind of shoot the breeze about poetry.
Yeah, I'd love to jump right into that. To give a little background, maybe just tell me what you're working on right now. What is it that you're currently involved in? And you're in Syracuse, New York now. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm currently in Syracuse. I've been living here for about 10 years now. My wife is from this area. She's from the Onondaga Nation, and so we kind of live near the reservation and, you know, conduct most of our life there. But I teach at Syracuse as an adjunct, and I also teach for the Institute of American Indian Arts Low Residency MFA program.
What is it that you're working on at the moment? And I want to ask you more about all of those things, but what are you currently involved in and working on?
So on the on sort of my personal work, Dark 30 came out about in 2009, which was my first collection of poems. And in that 10 years, I've been working on a second book of poems entitled Aurum, which is Latin for gold. And University of Arizona Press decided to pick it up, so it's currently in production. We're just kind of in early stages. We're talking about cover art, and I'm working with an artist named Chase Banks for some of the visuals that I, you know, would like to see go into the book, that kind of thing. But the poetry itself is essentially a distillation of 10 years of writing poetry, and very sort of aware of what I would consider my weaknesses in Dark 30 and stylistic sort of choices in that book. I tried to move away from that, from that work, not only content, but also in the crafting of the poems. And so the new book is kind of, it picks up where Dark 30 left off, but then kind of moves into a new artistic territory and then also into a different sort of poetic, I guess I would say.
And so this book this is what you're currently working on, and when do you expect this will come out?
University of Arizona says, the University of Arizona Press says fall of 2019. So I would assume this time next year I should have, you know, the book in my hands, hoping. But they were very good to work with last time, so I'm assuming that everything will be on schedule.
And I want you to read from that. I know you're going to read a few poems, but before that, I want to talk a little bit about the context of how you're working. And, you know, you mentioned quickly what your wife are doing on a reservation. Can you tell me a little bit about maybe just get involved in which will, I guess, lead us to how you grew up a bit, but what are you and your wife doing separately that you mentioned at the beginning that sounded like involvement with a reservation or somewhere near you?
My wife is from the reservation. She's very much a traditional person. She, you know, grew up in the longhouse and her religion. Doing ceremony and things like that. And for me, someone that grew up sort of in boarding school and all over the place in Indian country, and what I mean by that with in different communities and things like that across Oklahoma and into New Mexico, it was really important. We have two kids. It was really important for me and for Summer as well, my wife, to raise our kids in that environment. And to make sure that they're aware of where they come from, that they know their religion. And even if that's something that they choose not to practice, at least they've been exposed to it and they have the choice, right? My wife works, as a cultural worker. She does things with, in ceremony, things like that. But she also does their monthly newsletter publication and works for for the administration, the tribal administration, or the nation administration, and does work like that. I'm mostly, the work of a poet, and then also, teaching poetry that type of thing, but still very much interested in indigenous knowledge systems, indigenous thinking, perspectives about the environment, that kind of thing. But, you know, so we come from kind of two different backgrounds, right? My existence up until this point has been sort of at the sort of mercy of, you know, generational oppression and trauma, right? Going to boarding school, being sort of displaced outside of my homeland, as compared to my wife, right? They've occupied this land for thousands of years. They have, you know, their treaties are very different than a lot of other Native nations, that kind of thing. So very much, still very much, their culture.
So tell me a little bit about that, because I don't know what it means when you said your wife grew up in the longhouse. I mean, just to talk about the differences in how you were brought up, because that'll help me to understand more. Tell me, what is the longhouse and how she grew up, as opposed to the kind of nomadic boarding schools that sounded like you were growing up with?
Okay, so just to give you some reference then, I grew up in a Southern Baptist sort of religion, I guess. So I wasn't exposed to, you know, culture and things like that through my dad's side of the family. And through my mom's side of the family, they were all fluent Cherokee speakers, and they also practiced their religion, but I didn't have as much exposure to them from a very early age. And so,
but the religion wasn't, sorry to interrupt, but the religion wasn't Southern Baptist that your mother was practicing?
No, not her, but my father, and that's who mostly, well, in some ways raised me in Oklahoma City and in urban environments, right? And so his family was Southern Baptist, yeah, but they're Native, but they just didn't speak their language and they didn't practice their religion or culture. It was sort of this pan-culture, pan-Native culture that you often hear about, like maybe in Sherman Alexie books and things like that, powwow culture, stuff like that, but their religion was Southern Baptist. With the longhouse, it's the traditional religion of the Haudenosaunee people, which translates to the people of the longhouse, and that's Onondaga people, Mohawk, Oneida, you know, Seneca people, you know, people from New York. And that particular religion is, has been here for thousands of years, and so you know, my wife's community has fought a long time and very hard to keep that sense of cultural continuity and religion intact. Most of that religion surrounds different times of year associated with food, mostly like harvest, you know, sap, strawberry, you know, those types of things that are often a part of ceremony.
And in terms of education. You said you went to boarding schools, but you also got a BFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts. Was that very different than what your wife did? I mean, I'm just comparing to understand the different trajectories.
Yeah, that's where we met, actually. We met at that school in, I think, 1999. She was doing two-dimensional arts, painting and that kind of thing, and I came for creative writing. And so that's where we had met. And then from there, we had a son, and we decided, and we had a daughter also, and we felt like it was the best decision to come to Syracuse because this is where her family lived. And then also I was applying to MFA programs, and Syracuse had accepted me on full fellowship, and so it just seemed to be the easiest decision to make. For our family, and then also for my long-term, you know, I don't know if I call it career, but for my poetry, I guess.
Hmm. And I want to get to your poetry to talk a little bit about, but just it's the what your wife and I are doing, and your involvement sounds interesting, as well as your children. So you said, you know, your children are understanding more about your religion and your wife's religion. Does that mean that doesn't mean Southern Baptist, I would imagine?
No, they're active in the longhouse. I'm not religious at all anymore. So we were married in the longhouse here, which means since they're matrilineal, right, the kids are themselves Onondaga, right? They follow the mother's line. And so as a result of that, they practice her religion which is going to Longhouse and going to ceremony, that kind of thing. And since we were buried there, we wanted to make sure that they had that sense of continuity, right? That they were living in a household that's specifically Native and also specifically Onondaga, right? And that's really important to me. For my wife, that's very natural. That's who she's always been. For me, though, it's really important to get back to a sense of being Indigenous or being Native. And how do we do that in contemporary society, right, where we're constantly being moved into, or we have to choose to move into urban environments, those types of things where we're losing our culture, right? I think it's important that we try to find a way to at least get back into some sort of relationship with it,
Right. Well, that's why it's interesting also that I think it's important, that as you said, you're not a religious person or not anymore, but yet, when we have kids sometimes and we're talking about, understanding like who we are, it sounds like because of not only being married in the Longhouse, but also having children, now you have more of an involvement in something that's new for you, but very, very important, and a sense of kind of new, almost, I would imagine, sense of identity for you and your family.
I think so. I'm constantly aware of what I am and what I'm not, and I like the idea that I can make a conscious choice to be involved and deeply embedded in Native communities. But at the same time, I'm also, and I think it's important for me, especially in Native literature at large, right, to acknowledge the fact that, I am not I didn't grow up on a reservation. I don't speak for, that particular sector of Native people, those types of things. I think it's really important to kind of make that distinction, at least for myself. And I try to make that in poetry as well. And I try to create a poetry that's true to my experiences as a Native person, but also my ideas about, for lack of a better term, the type of oppression and type of oppression, marginalization, those big words, those types of experiences that we go through on a daily basis.
So let's talk. Let's hear one of your poems. You're going to read three of them. But what's the first one you have from us? And this is from the manuscript you're working on. I'm not sure if you mentioned the title.
Yeah, the title of the manuscript is called Arum. It's Latin for gold. So this I'll read first the opening poem, which is called Lactification, which is a term that's sort of related to Frantz Fanon, who wrote Black Skin, White Masks, but it's associated with the type of language that's associated with racial constructs. And then I'll go ahead and read that, and we can talk about it a little bit if you have questions.
Okay.
Lactification. Taught to gnaw, to take a switch across the arches, a worming sort whose armpits smell like mustard. Strike behind his ear, forearms lashed and etched, a bulbous fist strung with muscle, nose misshapen, fungal curds, frown ripped and chapped, nubbin that sounds like clavicle, pocked, a slurry of vice, tally of kin, a breath or a smother that utters moth wings sap to kindling. From a world stricken with slog and all manners of knifing, a scuttle of arum, a smattering of ochre between chomps and fangs, torquing his wrists from shackle. A culling of melanin, his skull ensconced in choir song, a tail of wiry locks, hank of charred skin. And so that kind of opens the entire manuscript, and So this is probably the most recent, well, it is the most recent poem, and it kind of sets up these different through lines that thread throughout the entire collection.
So let's talk a little bit more of that. I mean, that's really interesting, and as you're saying, yeah, it sets the tone for the collection. And this was a book that also got you a lot of attention. There was a good amount of reaction to this book as well, wasn't there? A good reception
for the first book, or
for the first book, not this one, but the first book. You seem to get a good amount of attention. You won awards and everything.
I was able to get a couple of fellowships, and the Lana Foundation was very generous and gave me 2 months in Marfa, Texas, to write. And some of these poems come from that time, but that was almost 8 years ago. I didn't plan on the poems coming so slowly from the first book, which seemed to write itself. And then also a couple of other fellowships from the School for Advanced Research, they gave me time to write, which is also where some of these poems come from. And then I was Native Arts and Cultures Foundation Fellow in 2015, where they gave me, some time to write as well. And so I'm grateful for all of that. I had no idea that after the first book that poetry would get so hard and so time-consuming in a way. I thought that I would be done with my second collection in, 1 or 2 years, and it took 10.
Right. So tell me, since you just read that one, how that's what's setting up this book. How does the setup, the intro, the tone of this book, and of course that poem differ from your first book?
I think with Dark 30, there was more of a sort of narrative, sort of impulse. Each one of those books kind of worked as a isolated narrative in a larger world of. What I would say of Native people living in different parts of Indian country, again, different communities, things like that across Oklahoma and New Mexico mostly. And so those were just, those poems kind of worked as these beams of light that kind of uncovered a specific story or moment or characters in that world. For this one, I was more interested in trying to strip away the narrative impulse and also strip away the phrasings and language associated with narrative as well. So instead, kind of working through, different colors, techniques, different sort of shapes and perspectives and that kind of thing to kind of make the collection cohesive rather than trying to tell stories over and over again, which I think Dark 30 in some ways is the same poem written over and over again with different language. And what I really wanted to do here was to make sure that I wasn't writing the same poem over and over again or writing the same book twice. And so that's probably one of the reasons why it took so long.
Right.
This poem itself sort of talks about this sort of the slow sort of erosion of culture and identity, and what are the results of that? What are we left with, right? What is a person left with when all of those things have been kind of stripped away? I think we always talk about preserving indigenous cultures and native cultures, which I've talked about a lot, but I kind of am interested in this idea that once there's a sort of language construct associated with Native people in English, and specifically American English, and that in and of itself constantly defines us and constantly follows us in all situations, in all forms of human life. And so that essentially defines who and what we are, and everything that we do is in some ways impacted by that language.
Right, right. So let's hear another poem. Thank you for reading that first one. What is the next one you're going to read?
This one's called Chalk, which is not chalk like chalkboard, but Chalk, it's the Mayan god of rain. I titled it, which I think is kind of apt for some of the images that sort of unfold. But again, I'll just go ahead and read it. We can talk about it.
Okay.
Chalk. With nails like almonds, he stirs the ropey strands, naming the gossip, clicking his tongue, spit whitening the creases of his frowning lips. Under his jaw, a gobbler shaking to some erased syllable, the sound of sapping or pecans unfastening from the limb. Along the rim of the bowl, the paint is thinning to steel, a vine of strawberries gnarling into mounded leaves he pulverizes between thumb and pointer. 35 years ago, a voice of poplar bark and mist healed the misshapen tongue, a tongue that sounded like river water slurring around a slick stone, the way unthawed snow shapes itself into the skin of snake root, and how, knife in one hand, potato in the other, the curved blade slicking away the dirty membrane, a fog shreds the balding hillside. So that's very much influenced by poets Richard Hugo and Larry Levis. This, some of those turns in the poem that happen toward the end. You know, I'm kind of interested in those turns or how to make associations in poems through sound and then also through image too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poem. So and so many images in there. So tell me a little more about this. This is now, of course, from your upcoming book, and which is, and this poem is similar, or not similar, but it like the last one. It sets the tone for the book as well. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is they both are from the first section. Yeah, the beginnings of the book. So the poems are a lot. They have a more of a conventional structure, but as the book progresses, it kind of moves away from there, right? So even with this, right? There's a voice, but there's no sense of the I or the speaker in that way. It's trying to the poems themselves are trying to rid themselves of those sort of narrative phrasings. But this poem initially started with a childhood memory that I don't quite I don't know exactly the circumstance or the context, but I just remember this man stirring a specific type of tobacco in a bowl when I was younger, and it was a sort of a modern metal bowl. But I thought it was significant because strawberries are significant in many Native cultures, and especially in the Northeast and in the East. And so the bowl itself had these sort of strawberries in them, and then the tobacco itself, which is, you know, has medicinal properties. And I was kind of writing toward that and trying to decode that memory in some ways, and then how that memory affected my perspective on the natural world and things like that. And so you see that the bowl itself, which is, again, a modern sort of, you know, thing, but it's being used for this sort of maybe ancient type of ritual or event that's happening. So I sort of was talking about that, and then I wanted to explain the voice of the person, even though I don't remember exactly what was said, but I wanted to kind of describe the sounds of the person. And so, you know, the voice of poplar bark and mist and, you know, the erased syllable, you know, and how also native languages work a lot of the times, which is native languages describe things in images a lot of the times more so than English does, which I think a lot of the times is specific. And so, the sound of sapping or pecans unfastening, I was kind of trying to capture those meanings in it. Not in a...
That's so interesting about language. I didn't know that English, that there's more descriptive terms you're saying as opposed to English.
Yeah, kind of interesting. So Onondaga Lake here is probably one of the most polluted lakes in the country, and they're talking about land remediation around here, and the Onondaga Nation really wants to see that lake restored. But there's been a couple of thinkers, John Mohawk was a Seneca scholar, but he talked about this. But there's this idea that we can't actually remediate land or restore it to its original state without understanding or using native languages to describe or to, as a way of describing what the land was before European contact or before it was polluted. Right, that native languages are the essential sort of elements of meaning for the natural world in the Americas, but in this case in North America. And so I was kind of trying to take those ideas, right, and putting those into descriptions, right, of how a native language might work. And it's not anything that's official or anything like that, but it was just something that I was experimenting with in the poems. And so there are a lot of elements of that. In this piece, and what I tried to do is I would try to create, a sense of that imagery, but then I was also trying to use meter and rhyme also to make those phrases turn a little bit too, to make them feel a little more significant in the poem.
I like that.
But the poem itself is an older person looking back on that memory, right? And that in that memory, right, it's not the scientific world that makes these things happen. It's a more of a spiritual type of place, right? And so what does it mean to have that type of consciousness? And I'm thinking about Gaston Bachelard's formation of the scientific mind and how much of an impact science had on the human brain. But then I think about that with Native people. Once we switched to English, right, the way that we understood the natural world and the natural environment changed drastically. And so this poem is trying to kind of wrestle with those ideas.
So you have one more for us. Go on. You're saying, but it's a theme, and then we'd love to hear the next one. Finish that thought. You're saying it's also a theme.
Yeah, it's and what does it mean? Like, so at the end of that poem, a fog shreds the balding hillside, right? We know that science that does that, but what if it happens to be the sort of God that's evoked through some kind of ritual, right? What is it, in some ways that's also what it means to be, for me, to be a Native person, right? How do I get back to that original way of thinking, right? Before we were forced to, to use a different language, before that we were forced to, engage in a different, type of culture, a different type of existence altogether.
Right.
So the next poem that I'll read is called Sanguinaria, which translates to bloodroot. And I'll read that. Sanguinaria. A bullwhip, handle wrapped with duct tape, the ends knotted to halt the unweaving. A revolver wrapped in a bandana, a fillet knife, buck blade, and a pair of brass knuckles, flecks of gold in the dents. Every Friday after work, he parked the T-Bird underneath the shade. I remember my toes gripping the limbs, watching as he unwrapped the pistol, cocked the hammer, squeezed the trigger, loaded the shells. I remember the wind dusting up the hillside, bending maple and oak, windows latching shut. He liked the quiet of a ditch, the snap of skulls crushing into smaller snaps, the way skin flays off the collarbone. And so that's kind of the end of that section. And from there, the poems kind of drastically turn into something else, but I'm really interested in this idea that I found in Eduardo Galeano's book, The Open Veins of Latin America, and I opened the entire book with the quote, the nobodies, nobody's children, owners of nothing, the nobodies, the no ones, the nobody running like rabbits, dying through life, screwed in every which way. And the entire book kind of deals with that particular type of figure going through different levels of oppression and also histories of violence and things like that, and kind of interested in how that plays out in contemporary Native existence.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, that's that's what's sort of the rub there, right? The imagery of violence and even mentioning the gun is it's disturbing. It's upsetting. It's a very different tone to come to grips with and to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the gun was so impactful for Native people. That's probably that one invention really did, it, in some ways affects every Native life, right? That technology and how systematic violence through that particular invention, led to our subjugation and things like that. I mean, there's also disease and things like that, but I focus mostly on the gun and other weaponry also, but the blade kind of pops up a lot in my poems too. So that's kind of the way that the poems, most of my poems deal with those objects specifically, and they kind of appear in and out of both collections of poetry.
Shanti, it's great hearing your work, and I look forward to, of course, the publication of this book that you're working on. And before we go, I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you're reading now. I'm always interested in what everyone else is reading, so just curious what you have on your nightstand now or wherever you're reading.
Yeah. I always have by my nightstand, making certain it goes on, the collective poems of Richard Hugo, and I just kind of keep it sitting by the bed, and every night I go to bed, I just, if I think of it, I'll grab that and read a couple poems out of that. But more specifically, his first collection, Run of Jacks, which I think is, I mean, if you read Run of Jacks, you can kind of hear that in the, echo in Arum a little bit. So I read a lot of Richard Hugo. I'm also reading, and I read a lot of, again, John Mohawk, Seneca scholar, and I've been obsessed with this essay that he wrote called Racism and American Ideology. And so I've been, I kind of read that. I don't know, sometimes once a week, it just depends on, how I'm, what my reading pattern is at the moment. And then, other than that, I just, I read a lot of Larry Levis, and especially his sort of moves with association. The Perfection of Solitude, that sequence is probably one of my, favorite all time. Works by him, but those are the poets that I kind of look to a lot. But I'm really excited about Sherwin Bidzui's new collection of poems called Dissolve that's out by Copper Canyon this month. I think that's going to be a major work in Native poetry.
Shanti, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time, and I wish you great luck with your manuscript to be published next year.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the great questions, and thanks for allowing me to read my work.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.